welcome to today's OCTF seminar. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Maurizio Venturini. And I've known Maurizio for a long time, since we were colleagues in Edinburgh in the late 90s and early 2000s. Before that, he did his undergraduate in Florence and his PhD in Edinburgh on the hydraulic architecture of plants, and then did a postdoc in Cornell, and was in Edinburgh as a lecturer from 1997, and still has an affiliation as professor of forest science at Edinburgh, but his main base is in Barcelona at the where he's ICREA research professor of plant and ecosystem ecology at the Research Center for Ecology and Forestry Applications in Barcelona. So, and his work, as you'll see here, covers plant hydraulic water relations at all scales, from small to ecosystem. So, welcome, Maurizio.
Many thanks for the invitation to come here. It's really a pleasure to be in the UK again. I spent a long part of my life, 17 years, all of my academic career in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and it's really nice to be able to come back to the UK. It's really my home still, I feel, and I feel torn. You know, I'm Italian, and I live in Spain, and I've spent most of my academic life in the UK. I really feel like this is coming back home all the time, so many thanks for the invitation. And so I chose this topic of, that's kind of a recurring theme of my research over time, of how drought impacts the behavior of plants, and particularly woody plants, and I guess I've gone back and forth doing various things related to plant physiology and ecosystem ecology, but this has been a focus of my research for a long time. So I'm glad that I have a chance to talk to you a little bit about these sort of things again. And so, where do I need to point? This one here? No?
You might have to just use the keyboard.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure.
That's okay.
For the laser pointer works.
Why is it?
It's just
seems to be stuck.
It's just left right.
I see. It shows okay here, actually.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's working. This is working as well. It's left right.
Okay, thanks. And so I guess I'll a few points of how I'm going to structure the talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about water more than carbon, really, because usually this is the stuff that I know most about, and then I'm trying to make some of the links when I think it is appropriate with regard to water and carbon fluxes. I'll talk about the traits that will be employed to describe water use by plants, and how this fit into sort of more standard descriptions of traits, functional traits in plants. And then, particularly with the focus of looking in the future at water prediction of water use. So, I guess perhaps it is appropriate to start from a slide that says we are not certain about a lot of things in the application of physiological knowledge to predictions of large scale fluxes of carbon and water. There are lots of uncertainties, sometimes also biases that. In this particular example, the paper that focused primarily on the carbon cycle, and then one of the main conclusions was then the uncertainties are associated particularly to the response of tropical vegetation to drought, and in case of boreal ecosystems, elevated temperatures and changing soil moisture status. So clearly there is a lot to understand there that we have to make in order to reduce these sources of uncertainties. And then that's true for the carbon cycle. It's probably even more true for the water cycle. And this is a summary of a compilation by these two authors a couple of years ago in Ag4Met, and they just described water fluxes, evapotranspirations by different biomes. And this was really a compilation of data from the literature of evapotranspiration by covariance, which is a measure of water fluxes at the whole ecosystem scale, or upscaling of the subflow measurements at the tree, from the tree to the stem scale. And I guess the main point that they were trying to make really is that there is a lot of uncertainties here in these measurements, whether you do them at the ecosystem scale or at the tree scale. And there is also, obviously, beyond the uncertainty and the variability from site to site, some sources of systematic biases. So if you look at an isotope-based method, you employ that method to partition the evapotranspiration of flux into the component that relates to tree fluxes, you get a fairly different response from the ones you get from empirical numbers that come from empirical variance and subflow measurements. And even so, even more so, when you look at the modeling perspective, you know, there are some fundamental variability in the responses. Jules, for example, stands out to be on these extremes of this distribution here, with a very low proportion of the ET flux that comes from transformation, a very large proportion comes from the population. So clearly, beyond the variability, the noise, the uncertainty, there is also issues of bias, which suggests we really need to be much better to understand what happens in terms of water flux in plants. Okay, so why is this important? Well, for many reasons, but I suppose this is one example of a fundamental reason is that forest ET, the water flux that goes through woody plants, trees, at various scales from stand to catchment and continent really is important in providing fundamental services for local communities. And so in the case here of South America, we go from a map of potential evapotranspiration to map of actual evaporation, and then to maps of the distribution of something called the percentage recycling of rainfall. And so this is the map that says how much of the water that is evaporating from each pixel here in the continent comes from oceanic water as opposed to water transpired by the vegetation. And there's a very large east-to-west gradient, so the water that comes that is employed here by the plants is effectively seawater vapor that comes from the ocean and then it rains over the vegetation here, whereas water that comes on this side here is really water recycled from the trees of terrestrial origin. They go through several cycles. And so this is well known for South America. You have this sort of stepping stones of sequential evaporation and condensation and rainfall, etc., which eventually leads to portions of the South American continent being really strongly dependent on these events. And so really, the concept of where does the precipitation happens to go really has a fundamental consequences on services that are providing to this very strong agricultural region. So we really need to be concerned about exactly how we model and what we understand about the fluxes through plants, particularly trees, even at the continental scale. And so we have all these uncertainties. We always try to go from sort of small scale prediction of traits, perhaps even at the organ level, tissue or organ, up to the individual, and then trying to jump up with some kind of boundary there and trying to make some predictions about an emergent behavior that occurs at larger temporal and spatial scale. Often we adopt some kind of detailed description of the physiology, and sometimes we attempt to prevent this accumulation of potential sources of uncertainty that come from making jumps from one scale to another by perhaps treating some of the components of the problem as if they have to do with some degree of optimization of behavior of plants. And so some assuming that the plants behave in some way, in an optimal way, so that we can simplify the problem. And there are a variety of methods that attempt to do that. And so I guess it boils down to these descriptions of traits that plants have. So people often refer to this as functional traits. I'll go back to that in a minute. But essentially, the fundamental idea is that we have some kind of community assembly here, then some kind of filter from the environment that sets a distribution of traits that characterize that community, and then we employ this cloud of this of traits, this distribution of traits to then input into a model, which then we employ to make predictions or check whether they allow to represent properly the composition of a community. This sort of description of going back to fundamental traits has been employed in a much more fundamental sense by ecologists and biologists, in really in the sense of trying to understand something about the evolution of the composition or the composition of this community, in the sense of trying to describe traits which really have a functional sense in a biological sense, rather, in other words, they really affect the performance of plants in terms of their growth, their reproduction, their survival, except to sources of mortality, etc. And so the double role of the traits is always always relevant, and it always needs to be kept in mind. On the one hand, we use them to employ them inside models because we think they can help to simplify the description of processes in models, and on the other hand, we also employ them because we think they can help us to understand a little bit more about the biology and ecology of communities. So we go to big databases like this that contain lots and lots of traits, and then we attempt to make the best use of these databases in order to understand something about plant behavior. And so that's an example of a summary paper that many of you, I suppose, would have read from Susana Diaz recently. And so that's an attempt to sum up the variability in these traits across a very large number of species, as if the plant behavior and the plant form really organize themselves around two main axes. One has to do with what is known as the leaf economic spectrum, or the stoichiometry of leaves, and another direction which has to do with plant size and seed size. And so these are some of the known potential spectra that people have referred to before, and that might help to understand some of the distribution of traits that are found across these databases. I didn't know what to expect in terms of audience. I don't need probably to spend an awful lot of time telling you what specific Leferia is. And the one thing I would say, though, is that it's always confusing the fact that much of the literature here is employed in terms of, expressed in terms of leaf mass per area, and then another fraction of the literature is instead expressed in terms of specific leaf area, which is 1 over LMA. And so it's part of this is tradition. Paul Jarvis used to tell me that we should employ specific leaf area, because specific leaf area specifically means unit of mass, and it has a very clear meaning in the international system of units. The American literature tends to prefer more the leaf mass per area formulation, and that's really because in the context of the leaf economic spectrum, it really gives you the unit that you probably care most about, which is really the mass in person of the unit. So anyway, this makes it confusing, but it's once you get your end around that, then you there's no problem. So just one last slide on the leaf economic spectrum, just to say, summarize this fundamental concept of the leaf economic spectrum that has to do really with some kind of mass investment in the plant makes to produce a certain leaf area. And so this mass investment then has to give a certain return, has to be returned back to the plant in terms of gain, which is the photosynthetic gain. And so this takes place over a variable interval of time, which is the lifespan of the leaf. So you have a gradient from conservative leaves that operate at high LMA, high mass investment per unit of area, but they work, plants that work at low rates, versus acquisitive leaves that for which the investment of the mass per unit of leaf area is very low. But this allows plants to, at the same time, to have very high rates of return. And so there are a number of trade-offs that are present in this spectrum of multivariate spectrum of traits. It's really, most of them have to do with the central role of leaf lifespan. So the leaf is built with lots of support structure, a lot of walls, a lot of material. There's a lot of investment in the leaf. The leaf tends to live much longer, is much more resistant to attacks by herbivore, etc. by the same time you tend to dilute the nitrogen, if you dilute the nitrogen on a per unit mass basis, then you tend to have low rates, but because you have a long lifespan, then you can, even though you have a low return period of time, you have a long time over which you can make that return, so eventually it works out. These plants, which are conservative, tend to have tend to return, to give back all the currency, which is the carbon uptake that has been invested in the infrastructure in the first place. So that's kind of a fundamental concept, the set of trade-offs that lead to the different spectrum. And so, okay, so that's more or less the concept I wanted to present. So one example of a piece of work we did a few years ago now, I was just taking advantage of a large inventory that was taken, took place in the Iberian Peninsula. There were a couple of inventories that we employed. One was a standard national forest inventory over tens of thousands of plots like we have in several countries. And to that, we coupled a second inventory which carries out was carried out in one of the regions of Spain, Catalonia, where for several hundreds, in some cases several thousands of plots, we had measurements of maximum tree height, of wood density, of leaf size, percentage nitrogen, specifically ferry and seed mass. In other words, all the major traits that make up all the various spectra that you think are present in plants. So don't want to say an awful lot about this study, just to say that once you add this sort of traits, then the fundamental logic, the one follows, is to say, okay, we have climatic conditions, we have fundamental traits, and then we ask the questions, do these traits actually relate to the performance, the demography? So this was an index of relative growth rate, this was an index of mortality rate from the forest inventories, and so how this, where do these harrows take place? Do we have direct effects of climate on the demography? Do we have effects that are mediated by climate through their traits, etc., etc.? And so that's kind of the fundamental concept. A few of these studies were done in, when we published this, there were not many studies done outside of the tropics. It was really primarily a tropical ecology type of exercise, and then since then many more have been done also in several other regions of the world. But I guess one of the things I've learned from this sort of work is that there are, in my mind, still question marks open regarding how general these findings are. More and more in fine papers that show that, in fact, it's rather hard to make the jump from a single study like this to make a generalization across several studies. There is, in my mind, also a fundamental question concerning making predictions at the global scale, using spectra like the economic spectrum, versus making predictions at much lower local scale. In other words, it's a common observation that when you go downscale from the global scale to more regional level, then you tend to find it's much more difficult to find convincing, predictive, powerful relationships that allows you to understand what's going on in terms of demography. That's certainly an open issue that requires, I think, more understanding. In my mind, certainly one of the outcomes of that particular study a few years ago was really the fact that first of all, there were missing dimensions there. No? So there's nothing about water, so it's only about carbon and nitrogen there. And so yet water is one of the main resources employed by plants. So how does that work out? And then there is also, in my mind, an issue as well about whole plants. At the end of the day, big question is, we talk about leaf properties, or we talk about tissue properties, perhaps good properties like the density, but do they actually translate to whole plant behavior? And how does that work out? You know? The suggestion from the previous study was that yes, they do, because you look at demography, and yes, they appear to be a relationship. But there is some things, the predictive power of those relationships is often very poor, like I said before. So why is that? And so, and equivalently, I think there is this assumption that we have hydraulic traits that are measured at the tissue scale or at the individual scale. How do they relate to feedbacks that occur at the ecosystem scale in terms of water flux? How do they relate to the control of water fluxes at the larger spatial scales? Okay, so I give you quite a few examples of what that we've done, trying in particularly focus on the products and trying to pursue these avenues of research and trying to put them back into the context of the trade relationship that I mentioned in here. So I had sort of a few digressions now about various examples of the research we've done, and then I'll go back to the issue of functional spectra. And so this is an example of looking at a compilation of global literature that has to do with measurements of leaf-hold potentials in plants. This is a measurement that plants have, that physiologists have been making for decades now. And rather surprisingly, the significance of these measurements has not been fully appreciated. And probably there are still lots of things that can be discovered just by looking more carefully at this data. So here have pre-dawn leaf-hold potential measurements taken before dawn, and here you have measurements of midday leaf-hold potential. And so pre-dawn water potential, you can take it as a more or less a proxy for soil water potential. And then mid water potential, midday water potential, leaf-hold potential, you take it as an indicator of the status of the water status of plants at the time of the day when they are most stressed. And then you look at seasonal time courses of these variables as they change. So they might change like that. So in other words, as the season goes by, you go from wet to dry, you move this way, the soil becomes drier, so you go from zero to negative, but the midday stays completely constant. So there will be a plant that controls completely, perfectly, its midday water status, completely isohydrically, despite the fact that the soil becomes much, much drier. Or you may have the opposite situation of a plant which just follows this one-to-one line. Of course, you cannot live on the other side. You only can live on this side here, this triangle here. So if the plant does that, then it just means that the midday, the water potential just follows completely the change in soil water potential that you have had. It's just proportional with an intercept shift. And then you can have intermediate cases of a plant which is not completely isohydric. It's not. This would be the anisohydric case. This is an intermediate case, and this would be in a plant which is so anisohydric that in fact its midday water potential becomes much more negative, relatively speaking, compared to the change in soil water potential, where the slope actually is greater than this one-to-one line. And so you look then at the literature, you find these are examples of some curves that you find in the literature. And I guess what's interesting here is that it turns out that, in fact, when you write these equations, that the slopes of this line is very much of significance. And we call the sigma, because that's a letter we had available that was not taken by other studies, and in a lot of reasons. But really, the fundamental use of that slope is really to indicate a balance between gaseous phase and liquid phase water transport, the relative sensitivity of these two processes. And so it turns out that this sigma property, which is the, you may not be able to see, is this letter down here, turns out that we can actually monitor it from space relatively well by using passive microwave measurements. So again, because this particular satellite takes measurements during the night and the middle of the day, then we do over passes on the same region of the world, then you can get an estimate, if you want, of the maximum degree of hydration of the canopy in one instance for the night measurements, and then for the day measurements, the measurement of the lowest level of hydration of plants. And so this other published first paper looking at the distribution of this degree of a isohydric behavior or an isohydric behavior, which has to do with, like I said before, with the balance between stomatal control and hydraulics. And then more recently, they use the same method to look at grasslands in the US and looking at how the sensitivity of NDVI, the normalized difference in vegetation index, over time due to drought, either VPD or precipitation, how that varies as a function of this isohydricity index. And it turns out that they were able to show that, in fact, that this changes over time in NDVI for each pixels, and particularly how this change is related to years of drought, either high VPD or low precipitation years, they related reasonably well to this azoharic index. In other words, this is a measure that really scales up from leaf level to the globe, can be employed in the global scale. Okay, number two, plumbing. And so plumbing, I guess a simple way to understand plumbing is like the stuff you do in your house. You know, you have lots of rooms, a big house, and you have a small house, but depending on how big your house is, you need more plumbs, more pipes of work, or fewer pipes. You need larger pipes, or you need smaller pipes. You need a larger pump, you need a smaller pump. So it's a really just getting water from one place to another place. And you need to set up your system so that you do it in the most efficient way. That's most of what there is. And given that Brian is here, I'll just quickly mention that, in fact, you can look at this sort of probably really in a sort of factor sense. You know? So there's a whole literature there, as you probably are well aware, that looks at this sort of concept of how you scale up. You scale up the properties they have to do with the individual pipes to the whole system. So being efficient is one concept. Another concept is safety. And so imagine that you have a straw, you're trying to suck up your orange juice, and then the straw contracts a little bit under tension. In other words, your pressure that you create inside the straw is slightly lower. And so, well, and that drives the flow. And so the fundamental difference between the straw and the orange juice there and the conduits of plants and the water is really that plants drive this tension way down past the zero on the other side. So it's now in the negative region of water potentials, and really we are in a state in which plants water becomes later stable. In other words, not necessarily completely stable from a physical point of view, and susceptible to damage by a process called embolism and cavitation. And so you build up these curves, which typically tend to be sigmoidal, and these curves really say something about the water status of the plant here. And again, we go from sort of zero to negative, and so the plant, well hydrated, are over here, the dehydrated ones are over there. And this curve here tells you something about the percentage loss of conductivity. So as you move from well water to dry plants, then the plants tend to lose the conductivity, and so tend to become more and more embolized. And so this concept of safety is central to much of the hydraulic literature, and we have indices that have to do with the shape of the curve or the position of the curve along the axis, and the fundamental one index is called P50 or P88. They really give you sort of the tension that you have inside the plant, at which point you have lost, for example, 50% of your capacity to conduct, or 88% of the capacity to conduct. So a plant that lives like this is a plant which is very vulnerable potentially to embolism. A plant that curve like that tends to be much more resistant. And really, the figure here is just to remind you that the fundamental problem for trees to get the water from down there to over there. And so the reason why we have all this carbon locked up here is really because we need the pipes to get the water from down there to over there. And so it's a question of efficiency, and it's always a question of safety for water movement. And so that's a paper that summarized some of this literature on sensitivity of vegetation to drought that came out a few years ago. So here the data were summarized by the two major groups, gymnosperms and angiosperms. And the fundamental concept here is that when we look at the axis here of the vulnerability to embolism, the property that I mentioned before, so this would be the P50, and this would be the actual minimum water potential that plants experience if you the drought sequence, that what we find is often, particularly for the angiosperms, that there is a very strong coordination between these two. In other words, the plants that tend to live in dry sites and tend to experience very negative minimum water potentials, these are also the plants that are normally well equipped to live in those sites, so they tend to have very negative P50. And so they tend to live along this line. The distance between the one-to-one line and this line here, we call that the safety margin, and so it will be very, very small, or sometimes equal to zero for many of the angiosperms, and much, much larger in the case of the gymnosperms. And so there's a lot of interesting information here that comes up from this compilation that we did. And really, the fundamental one really has to do between this, has to do with this fundamental compensation between or coordination between the vulnerability of the plant and the actual water potential in which the plants live. In other words, the different way to say this concept is that there is a fundamental difference between vulnerability and sensitivity. So this is actually how vulnerable potentially an organ is. This is the actual risk that the plant experiences a very low water negative water potential, and therefore the result of these two really gives you how sensitive the vegetation really is to drought. Okay. And then the fourth element that I'd like to mention in terms of hydraulics really is the allocation balance that you have in plants, that, particularly with regard to allocation to conductive tissues versus the leaf area of a plant. Again, making reference to allometry here. Now, what I did here, I had this picture of a small Scots pine, and I just dragged it along the corner, as you do what normally with your mouse, to make it bigger. Well, what I have done really here is just assuming that everything is isometric. It isn't. It's not true at all that plants behave like that. Most often, the way things are built inside the roots, inside stems and branches, don't necessarily scale isometrically with other things like leaf area, for example. So you need to worry about these sort of things quite a lot and think about what is the best balance given the circumstances, given the tree structure, etc., tree size, etc., that really allows the plant to survive under certain particular sets of conditions. Okay, so these are the four characters, four traits that really I think are really, really important. Water status of a plant, especially as measured by water potential, but the other measures can be equally adequate, like water content, efficiency in the water transport system, the piping concept of the pipes in your house, the safety from embolism, and then the allocation ratio, which normally we describe as Hoover values, or alternatively as leaf to saplings ratio. And this is another example of a ratio which can be expressed as one over the other. And so it's sometimes also confusing to think about because you have to work out which units you are actually talking about in each particular case. So the rest of the talk, I'll spend it now just giving you a few examples of why I think this hydraulic traits have significance and how we can use them. And so this one example is a work in progress of a global database that we're building that a colleague of mine, Rafael Pigatos, is building in CREAF. It's called SubFluxNet, and it's a global database of subflow measurements. Currently in the database there are about 100 sites, and not many from the tropics. We'd like to have more, but nonetheless, the database will provide a unique source of information in terms of understanding behavior of trees, of plants, at the individual or at the stand level, and really looking in detail at the controls that regulate this water use by woody plants. Some of the preliminary analysis already suggests that there are some fundamental regularities that you would expect to occur at both at this level here and at this level, and with this level there. So there is a lot of work went into this, the construction of an R package that does all the processing and all the visualization and helps with the gap filling and some of the preliminary analysis that are required. I'll briefly mention a line of research that I pursued a little bit in the last few years that had to do with measurements of growth of trees. And I think, going back to the slide I had before, really measuring growth of trees is essential if we are to understand the carbon cycle. But turns out that, in fact, I believe there is one of the areas where there is a very strong link between hydraulics of trees and carbon cycle. And so in this paper here and some of the other papers that are cited there, I proposed a method that effectively allows to look at very highly time-resolved measurements of stem growth to separate the component of irreversible growth from a component that has to do with the reversible elastic shrinkage and swelling to do with water transport, but also with osmotic signals that potentially have a flowing origin, as opposed to water potential origin. And so some of the questions that I looked at that I think are interesting and is an issue like, when does it trigger? Just a fundamental, in a sense like, oh God, surely we know the answer. No, we don't. I'm sorry, so we don't know. Does it grow during the day or during the night? Well, actually, it turns out that some trees grow when you don't expect them to grow. Right? Whereas the assumption normally is that trees should grow at night, and they don't. And then hydraulics as well, the link with between the growth and hydraulics, I think it's an underexplored area. I'll give you one example. And so in this particular case, this is a data, an idea that Clayton Heller, a PhD student with Rafael Oliveira at the University of Campinas in Brazil, pursued, that has to do with the linking xylem growth with xylem embolism. And so this is a different trade-off from the safety efficiency trade-off that people always discuss in terms of hydraulics. It really has to do with a simple idea that assuming plants have some potential losses of xylem due to embolism, then you ought to expect some kind of coupling between how much trees grow and how much xylem they normally potentially lose because of water stress. In other words, what does it mean? That if you are a slow-growing tree and you live in a very dry area where you lose a lot of xylem by embolism, then you're probably in trouble because you don't grow enough to compensate for the long-term losses that you get by drought. Or equivalently, at the opposite extreme, you know, if you live in an area where there is very little risk of embolism and you're growing an awful lot of xylem, then why do you do that? Why don't you invest all that carbohydrates in something more productive, like thinking about your production? So the prediction from this sort of simple idea would be that there should be some kind of coupling here. Plants that grow slowly, they also should live in areas where there is very little risk of embolism. If you have a lot of risk of embolism, probably you should think about replacing your xylem quite a bit. So your rate of growth should follow. And so that sort of concept here, coupled with concept of safety, then Clayton tested it in a tropical montane cloud forest and looked at this relationship between maximum growth rate extracted from using the method that I mentioned in the previous slide and the hydraulic safety margin coming from the vulnerability curves in the measured water potential. And so the outcome seems to support the idea in the sense that trees that have low safety margins are trees that have high rates of growth. If you have high rates of growth, you tend to live in a region that where there is less safety. If you want to have a lot of safety, then you tend to live in a region which links to lower growth. I think there's a lot here that can be done to understand better this sort of scaling. Another area that I think is quite important is this idea of improving understanding and prediction of stomatal behavior. This is a very old idea that goes back to Cowan and Farquhar, you know, 50 years ago, predictions of optimization of water use efficiency. And lots of work has been done here and continues to be done. Remarkably, I think we have reached the phase where we can probably say, well, we don't need this lambda optimal water use efficiency factor anymore. Exactly what the new optimization function would be, it's not completely clear at the moment, but I think this proposal by John Sperry goes a long way. And the fundamental concept really is that we need to think of an optimization function that comes from traits that we can measure and nothing else. And so in this particular case, there is a cost function, which is a day vulnerability curve. So in other words, a plant that has a very shallow vulnerability curve, and so this is the cost, potential cost of losses of conductance of embolism. This plant here will behave differently from a plant that has a different curve. And then there is a photosynthetic gain function which comes directly from ACI curves, and parameters like VCmax and Jmax. And so the fundamental concept is that plant will tend to live in terms of stomatal opening, which is this axis here. All stomata are closed over here, they're open over there. The plant wants to open, wants to move along this axis as much as possible to open the stomata and push up photosynthesis along the ACI curve. At the same time, as if you do that, you get so much stress inside your plant that you begin to lose conductivity. So there is an optimal situation over there, an optimal combination where you maximize your photosynthetic gain given your hydraulic costs. And so there are different solutions, but I think that one can come up with. But I think the beauty of this solution here is, like I said before, is that it's only based on two measured traits that we have quite a lot of data already in the literature. And this approach has been followed by a number of people now to be incorporating a number of models, and one of those is groups in Exeter, led by Lucy Roland, again with Clayton, and Peter and Steven in Exeter, and they're trying to incorporate these sort of simple rules into Joules. The beauty of this approach, I suppose, is that it simplifies a considerable model parameterization. We don't need to worry about the beta functions, the response of transfer or stress, and we need to worry about an optimal efficiency, we need to worry about the response to the beta. The final example that I'm going to give with this it goes back to this issue of the diffeomorphic spectrum, and how hydraulic properties can be employed to improve our understanding of whole plant strategies. And so how the diffeomorphic spectrum relates to other possible spectra of plant behavior. So what we did effectively, really the original idea here was to try and couple hydraulics with leaf economics, effectively trying to couple data sets that come from the leaf economic spectrum with data came from the paper that we published that I showed you before with Brendan Choate, that summarized the hydraulics data. And then we added other data sets in hydraulics that were not present in here, particularly trying to cover regions of the world which were not very well covered, like Australia, China, and the tropics. And then a number of steps to quality control the data, which I'm not getting into at the moment. And so we go back to this analysis of the leaf economic spectrum. This is the slide I showed you in the beginning. So this is the relationship between Amax photosynthesis versus LMA. And this is the relationship of Amax versus nitrogen. And so they go one way. In this case, they go the opposite way. In that case, but they still mean the same thing. You have low photosynthesis. It means you have you are a conservative leaf with slow return because you have very high LMA, a lot of investment, a slow return, and you have low nitrogen because of the large investment in LMA, or the nitrogen has been diluted. Whereas you are an acquisitive leaf, if you are in the opposite part of the spectrum because you have fast return here, you did not invest very much in terms of LMA. You have therefore very high levels of percentage nitrogen per unit of mass, and you have very high rates of return per unit of time. That was a fundamental concept. How does this compare to the hydraulic data? So this is the hydraulic data for the combination of this nine data sets that I mentioned before. So it's a global scale analysis like all the other ones. It suffers from the same sort of problems that I mentioned before with regard to global scale analysis. So we are looking at tissue level properties. This you have SLA in this case, and you have nitrogen. We chose these two properties as a plot because these are the ones for which there are more species in the literature. But the sort of results you get are exactly the equivalent than if you use assimilation rates, or leaf lifespan, or properties measured on a mass basis, or on a failure basis. So what is that happens here? It happens that the fundamental trade-off of the diffeomorphic spectrum goes this way. This is SLA, it's 1 over LMA. So leaves with low SLA have high LMA, so they have a large leaf mass investment per unit of area. So these are the conservative leaves with low nitrogen, okay, low photosynthetic rates. And these are the acquisitive leaves with the low investment in mass and high percentage of nitrogen. And so when you look at this spectrum here, the first thing you see is that there is a modulation of the spectrum which is caused by hydraulics. So the colors here refer to either hydraulic efficiency, and this is called KS, hydraulic conductivity, measure of how efficient these pipes are in transporting water, or the color refers to P50, the vandenberg. And so these relationships are all highly significant. There is a significant modulation of the traits by the hydraulics. And so they go in the way you would expect. In other words, when you go towards leaves which are acquisitive, high area per unit of mass, these are also correspond to xylem, which is very efficient. if you think of leaves which are very conservative, they tend to correspond to xylem, which is also less efficient. In other words, if you have a leaf which tends to work at high rates, that's because it does not have a huge investment in its mass, but the rates are quite high, then you would expect that the xylem would also be coupled in the same direction and be very efficient, which is also what happens in this graph here. And the situation reverses itself when you look at the safety part of the graph. So plants which are very vulnerable, which are again this color here, tend to have higher values of SLA relative to nitrogen. And the slopes tend to go above. So in other words, particularly in this part of the spectrum, if you tend to have more acquisitive leaves, you tend to be coupled to xylem, which is very vulnerable. So the conclusion of, if you look at this modulation, the changes in slopes or the intercept, you conclude that inacquisitive leaves are coupled to efficient but vulnerable xylem, and relative with the opposite case, conservative leaves tend to be coupled to an efficient resistance xylem. Beyond this sort of modulation, there is also a sort of clumping of points. You can see very clearly here, the red points tend to be focused much more, present much more in this region than there, and the opposite tend to be the case for the yellow points over here. So beyond the fact that the spectrum is modulated, there is also a clustering of points, which is kind of hard to see here because you really have to work your way along the spectrum. So a better way to look at this is actually to plot the properties here, the hydraulic properties here, directly against one of these two properties, this one here, or this one there, or the combination of the two. And so that's the next graph. Does that. So here, now everything is plotted against SLA, which is the most frequently measured property. So if you move along the SLA axis here, you tend to move towards acquisitive plants, high area, pyramidal mass. If you are on this end here, you tend to be towards the conservative end, you know, a little low area of the leaf pyramidal mass. And so you can see very clearly here now that there is highly significant changes in the vulnerability to cavitation here, from resistance to vulnerable, and also in the efficiency of the xylem, from low efficiency here to high efficiency. So these are the same graphs as the one I showed you before, just rotating the axis and looking directly at the effect of hydraulics. So the conclusion is, in terms of hydraulics, that there is this coupling between different xylem. If conservative leaves tend to correspond to not very efficient but resistant xylem, whereas acquisitive leaves tend to correspond to efficient but vulnerable xylem. And so the interesting thing is that actually that's not the whole story. And so the whole story comes out when you actually consider the whole set of four properties I mentioned before, and not just a measure of vulnerability and a measure of KS, but when you also consider an allocation and when you consider the water status. And so these four properties combine to make up really the whole plant behavior. In other words, going back to the comment I made before with regard to the vulnerability curve, this is a P50, tells you something about the vulnerability curve. The siamine tells you something about the actual risk that the plant is under, giving the water potential. And then the hydraulic safety margin tells you something about the actual sensitivity of the vegetation to stress. And so if we focus on this line down here, then what happens is very similar to what we saw before in the plot from the Choate paper about the global scaling of the hydraulics. You know? In other words, we see that, yes, there is a trend at the tissue scale that relates xylem property to leaf property in terms of vulnerability to gravitation. However, there's also the same trend that takes place with regard to the minimum leaf water potential. That's hardly a surprise, because what that means is that when you live in a wet site, you tend to have leaves which are more highly SLA, low mass investment. When you go towards drier sites, you tend to have leaves that tend to have much lower SLA. Really, this becomes a bit confusing here to look if you think about it, because then they need to take log or negative numbers, so they have to turn them down. But effectively, these are wet areas, these are dry areas. So this trend here is very much linked to climate. But the fundamental concept then is that if you put these two together, you calculate the hydraulic safety margin. In fact, there is very little relationship overall, none at all if you combine angiosperm and gymnosperm. And in fact, the relationship goes the opposite direction that you would expect. So there's a complete compensation of the whole plant scheme, such that this coupling between this property and that property disappears or reverses the direction completely to what you would expect. And when we look at the efficiency part, the same thing happens. It's true that there is a coupling between the leaf property in terms of high acquisitive leaves and high efficiency value. However, it turns out the very acquisitive leaves tend to have a higher leaf to succulent ratio, or if you want a lower Huber value. Plants, if you decide to spread your area, making lots of thin leaves, where you end up with very large leaf to succulent ratio. And so, consequently, when you combine the two things, the efficiency of the xylem and the allocation ratio, the combination of the two gives you a measure of whole plant conductance per user leaf area, and then there is no relationship anymore. So in this particular case, really what we find is that there are two fundamental compensations here, for the safety axis and for the efficiency axis. And there are these compensations that occur across the four properties that make this distinction between conservative and acquisitive leaves completely irrelevant on the space scale of the hydraulics and the whole plant hydraulics properties. The leaf specific hydraulic conductance or the hydraulic safety margin, what things in fact even go the opposite direction. So, conclusions. I went quite fast, but I hope I was clear enough. I apologize if I went too fast. I suppose the fundamental themes that I wanted to go through was really the idea that I think it's quite important to consider hydraulics if we are to understand the patterns at global scale of water use and water stress resistance. I think some of the data I showed you at the beginning, looking at the upscaling of isohydric behavior versus isohydric behavior, suggested in fact that even at the global scale, that's fundamental property measure, the leaf scale can in fact be upscaled and mix the interpretation of things like NDVI quite more interesting. When we went back to the issue of leaf economics and how the leaf economics coordinates to xylem traits, we found coordination of these properties at the tissue scale. Acquisitive leaves tend to be coupled to efficient xylem, etc. But I suppose the fundamental message was that we added the water dimension to the fact that to the carbon and nutrient dimensions that were within the leaf economic spectrum. And we found a fundamental compensation at the core plant level that resulted from this coordination, this whole property. And so as a result of this compensation, really, it would seem as if what the hydraulic does is to constrain the significance of the leaf economic spectrum from leaf scale to core plant scale. And I think convince you that it is important to consider hydraulics for understanding of the coupling of carbon and water cycle, and particularly for improving the performance of vegetation management. Thank you.